This is Suno India production. You can now listen to all our episodes on our Android and iPhone app. Download it now.
The run-up to COP28 this year has started, and this is a pre-COP episode where we spoke to young climate leaders about what they think of climate negotiations. Now, as the world leaders prepare for COP28, how much will they listen to the varied experiences and insights of the generation that is least responsible for climate change, yet most vulnerable to its consequences? Why do more young people need to engage in the climate dialogue? What can they contribute, and why is the push for youth participation in climate negotiations so strong? Hi, I'm Sneha Richharya, your host for this episode of Climate Emergency. For this episode, Rakesh and I spoke to Heeta Lakhani and Aditya Mukherjee. They are two of the 17 young climate leaders whom the UN has recognized through its We the Change campaign. Heeta is also an elected global focal point of the youth climate movement, which is a constituency of the UNFCCC.
Heeta, I want to begin with you. When exactly did you realize that, you know, you need to speak for the environment? We all had our own, time when we used to started reading about climate and what it means, because I'm also kind of young only, and I started reading it at some point. But I want to know your story. When exactly, you started thinking about it?
Yeah, thank you. Well, for me, climate came much later, but environment had always been a big part of what I wanted and what I was actually just, I like being, and kids like to be out in the open. They like to be in nature, and I was one of those. Even on birthdays, for example, like I remember, looking after an injured bird or something. So it wasn't really it was part of my day to day, it wasn't something different. But when I was around 13, I think I was coming back home from school, and I lived in Bombay, and there was a beautification project of Marine Drive that was going on, and they were taking out these coconut palm trees that lined the coast, and they were either transplanting them or putting them somewhere else to make way for the Marine Drive and to build what we see today as the promenade. And that's when, I was coming home that afternoon, and there was this huge coconut palm tree on a trailer. So instead of being vertical, it was lying horizontal. Its roots were out. The leaves, of course, you could see the whole tree from root to the leaves, but lying horizontal. And that image until today, it's stuck in my head. And that shook me. I felt very hopeless. I didn't know what to do. And I remember when I came home, I was in tears, and my mom had to actually console me that afternoon. And of course, that didn't lead to anything, but that stayed with me. And I think it was that experience when I was, jokingly, I think somebody told me, oh, if you care so much, why don't you be an environmentalist? So I think that stuck in my head. And I think ever since I was 12 or 13, I kept telling people, I'm going to grow up to be an environmentalist, without even fully understanding what it meant. So I think that's where it started. That was one memory that I remember clearly many, many years ago. And then, of course, I did a master's in environmental studies. I wanted to, study it ever since when I started, deciding what I want to do my degree. And I eventually decided not to pursue this in my bachelor's, because sometimes, you feel like you want to do something as a child, but then you're passion and your interest might be very different than what you actually want to do. But eventually that stayed, and so I did a master's in the field. And after master's was when I got more involved in the climate space. So climate came much later, but it was always more of environment or wildlife, or I was initially actually thinking of maybe conservation. So that was a different sector. And then sort of climate, I think, came to me as I got more involved in the UN since 2015. And since then, I wouldn't think of anything else now.
Yeah, that's nice. Where did you do your master's?
I did my master's at Terry University in New Delhi.
So even I have done my master's in environment science. I did, and then, you know, I got into the climate space. I worked in climate change policy advocacy.
Okay.
Then started Suno India. So, yeah, after I also used to live in Delhi before. We moved to Hyderabad because of the air pollution, mainly because of the air pollution. Anyway, you know, as children, you know, we start seeing the things around us, and then, you know, something, you know, for some people it sucks. And I'm glad you took up environmental science and continue to do what you're doing. So from there, how did you get into climate negotiations? I mean, because I know a lot of people do environment science. A lot of people also, you know, then get into, like you said, you know, conservation or into policy work and stuff like that. But how climate negotiations happened?
So I think the initial bit was by chance. So in 2015, so after I finished, I graduated from my master's in 2014. So it's been a little while. I was then working actually as a German language translator for a multinational corporation in Bombay. So I was doing nothing related to the environment. But this was when COP21 was about to take place in 2015. And there was a buzz in the media like a few months before, you know, in the lead up to it, you know, climate summit with lots of expectations, world leaders are expected to be there, and the whole sort of the media noise that started building up by then. So I got a little, I mean, I got curious. I didn't exactly know what happens at the negotiations, but I mean, it clearly felt like this was the place to be. So I started asking people on like how I could be there. I looked online to register, and now, of course, I laugh at myself because I know the process behind it. But as a naive, like, you know, newbie, I had no idea what to do. So I asked around, and eventually, I think by like a few days before the COP was supposed to begin, I think a week before, someone wrote to me and said, okay, you know, we can give you a badge for 1 week. And so that, I remember I was in the office when the phone call came. So from the office, I booked my ticket to Paris. And I spent my month's salary to like just go to Paris and come back. So I was there for a week. I also went for the conference of youth that happened before, for a few days before. That was COP11. And more than the COP, actually, I thoroughly enjoyed the COP. Like the energy, the passion, the, you know, the whole feeling that the out of the 3 days of the COP that was there was very, very energizing, was very exciting. I had never seen so many different young people from so many different countries all in one place at the same time. So it was also a lot of learning, you know, understanding cultures, just meeting so many different young people. And then, of course, there was a COP where I was there for a week, and I had no training. I didn't have any capacity building, so I didn't know what to do. So, of course, I went to the COP, but was very overwhelmed with the size of the space, the sheer number of people, and, of course, everything that goes on in parallel at the same time. At least like 15 things going on together at one place, and then, you know, just trying to figure out and navigating that. So that was quite a challenge, but I think that's when I came back, you know, the UN wasn't, or the negotiations were not my focus, but when I came back, I was reflecting, and I wanted to be back in the environment sector, or at least, if not climate, like at least in the environment sector. So a few months later, I quit, and then I started volunteering. And that's where I think I got more and more involved. And then in 2016, so the next year, I was with a youth delegation who was sending a delegation to COP. So I was again there for another week in 2016. And this really helped because I was with other young people. When I went in 2015, I was by myself. I didn't know anybody else. And it was the first time I had been internationally to a UN conference of this scale and size. So it was overwhelming, intimidating, all of that. But the next year, it really helped because I met other young people. I, you know, found a sort of community. And even though I had seen the youth constituency, I was at COI and I had sort of engaged in their sessions, I was a very shy kid to like walk up to somebody and ask, how do I become a part of this? So that sense of community really helped me. That sort of got me more involved, you know, in the youth constituency, which is called Yango. So after COP as well, I came back, I was already had joined the mailing list. So I, you know, joined a few working groups and got engaged more and more. And then I think from then it was just sort of an upward sort of learning curve for me. So extreme in being more and more involved in the working groups, understanding the processes, then also going to the intersessions in 2017. So between the COPs, between the negotiations, they have the intersessions. So I started getting engaged more and, you know, So then understanding the negotiations, actually sitting in the rooms, you know, trying to find online like the documents. So then I think it was a very steep but very organic learning curve. And then in 2019 at COP25 was when I was elected as Yango Focal Point. So I now finished my mandate after COP26. I finished my mandate after the pandemic, and now working with young people on the other side of the room. So not as young people as observers, but youth as negotiators this time.
But, you know, Ita, this is one thing that I want to understand. I mean, it's, of course, a long story and it's an after story. But because I heard you in one of your interviews, you said that even after having a graduate degree in environmental science, you really struggle to understand climate negotiations, which I think is the same story for all those who are just beginning to kind of read all of it. Very complicated things, words thrown left, right, center, and, you know, understanding it, it becomes quite difficult. So I want to understand from you, I mean, how did you figure that out at that initial stage? Now, of course, you have come very far. But at that stage, what did you do to understand it? Plus, how should other people get involved in it? Because I see, and I am sure you also meet a lot of other youngsters who might want to kind of get into this space. So what is the way?
So for me, it was, for me, actually, a lot of it just, I had to learn on the go. Because initially when I got more and more involved, it was the youth constituency that sort of helped. Of course, I met a lot of young people and some of them were very helpful. Like I remember sitting in the rooms where someone was, you know, actually trying to explain to me what was happening. Even when you're sitting in a negotiation room with all of the different words and the commas and the brackets and, you know, all of that, like if you don't have the sort of initial, like, how do you say, like the outline of how to figure it out, it can take forever to learn it by yourself. So that really helped for me. Basically, I think the biggest thing that supported was, or that the biggest sort of upward curve for me was the fact that I had a few friends. It wasn't like a large number, but I had a few friends who were, you know, open to teaching me and sort of holding my hand and guiding me through the way. So basically capacity building, and this, it came very informally. Like I didn't undergo a capacity building course, and, you know, maybe if I had done some training beforehand, or had I received capacity building, it probably would have been easier already, like at the start, to navigate at least a little bit. I wouldn't have taken so long. So I think this is one thing that has stuck with me throughout. And there are basically two outcomes of that. One is just training and capacity building. The second is just having a sense of community. Which we've now tried to do in the program that we've co-founded, or that I've co-founded recently. But basically, I think for every young person getting involved, this has always been my thing. Like, I think one is, of course, now there are a lot more training programs available. So even, even a lot of like data, or not data, but necessarily information is like, people are trying to simplify it, putting it out on social media. The youth constituency, which is Yango, does before COP, does a few training sessions on, like, you know, understanding what's going to happen at that COP. Its working group presents on, like, what are the big thematics and what is, you know, to be looked at. So there is a lot more, like, even dissemination of information available than, let's say, even back in 2015. And before that, I'm sure it was a lot more harder anyways. So I think the first step for anyone wanting to get involved is, like, try and find out where you can. It can be through Yango, it could be through other youth networks, youth organizations, or whatever that might be. But try and find some amount of training, because when you go there, the COP is overwhelming. It is one of the most overwhelming spaces that you'll step into. So having a little bit of framework around that really helps, rather than just going in like a headless chicken. And then I think that the other is just, and this is where youth networks come in handy, because you meet other people, you know, around the same age as you. You can talk, you of course learn about different cultures, but you make friends, and friendship really helps to just make sure that you're doing okay when, you know, it's such an intense day, or, you know, just if you can't find something, maybe someone else has access to a particular document or knows, you know, as simple as like, where can you go buy something, or where is the nearest supermarket or the nearest doctor, for example, if you need help. So things like this, I think these are the two initial things that if you can get hold of, and then of course, you know, you can then see and pick and find pieces that are most useful for you.
Yeah. And of course, I think there's one more thing. You've already talked about it, but I also want to understand why and how, because we know that, you know, COP is basically coming together of all the climate world leaders and, you know, very important people talking about very complex things. So why do, and I also see that there's a lot of conversation that has started happening. The push up is really strong about how young people should join this conversation. So why do they matter? And what is it that when, let's say, a very young person like me or you, we go there, what is it that we contribute to that negotiation that is happening there?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think the first thing is to understand, I mean, you're only able to contribute to a COP if you understand how it works, and which is why I've constantly emphasized that training or capacity building or whatever you want to call it, you know, knowledge building is really, really important before you go into a COP. And then is also second is expectation settings. So one is like you understand the framework and you know how things are working, at least a little bit, at least you get some sort of an idea before you go in. And the second is like really setting your expectations right, because when you go into a COP, the countries come with their positions set months before the COP. So when you go into a COP, you know, as a young person, and I've spoken to so many young people over the years who go like, I need to be at COP28 because I want to make change at what the outcome is going to be. And that's really not going to be the case. If you want to make change at the COP, you already need to get involved, you know, a few months or at least a year or maybe even more than that before. So if you get involved today at COP28, by the time you understand and you can make, you know, you're able to even make, you know, a tiny 0.1% of change, it's probably going to take until COP29 at the earliest. At the earliest, it's going to take a year. So because the space is complex, you need to understand how people work, you need to understand negotiators, you need to understand dynamics, who do you approach for what. And the reason is because when you go there as a young person, more often than not, you're not going as a negotiator, you're not going as a decision maker, you're going in as an observer, which means that you can observe the negotiations, you can lobby, you can advocate, you know, you can do a lot of behind the scene conversations, but you are not sitting at the decision making tables, you're not making those decisions, unfortunately. And we need to have both sides of things. We need to have young people in the rooms making the decisions for their countries. And then we need to have young people outside who are not necessarily bound by country positions, bound by rules of what they can and cannot say. And then have the liberty to really, you know, push, go the extra mile and call countries out or call people out, or, you know, actually like, you know, be as open as any young person would like to be. So understanding what your role is going to be at a COP is very important to really set expectations right and say, you know, I'm going to go and, okay, probably like, you know, engage in side events, speak there, but that doesn't mean that negotiators are going to hear me in the side events. There could be a negotiator at the side event, but more often than not, people in the room are not going to be negotiators. So you're not going to, like, by saying brilliant statements in the side events, it may or may not actually percolate into the negotiating rooms. So just, which is why you need to understand, which is why the training is so important, to really know where are the areas that you want to engage. Where are the areas that can actually make change? Like going in and saying, I'm going to go to COP and I have like 3 events to speak at and 5 media interviews and I'm going to make change is really like, yes, you might have a lot of media headlines, but you're not going to make change in the room. So I think that is just like setting that right for young people is very, very important, because then that helps you when you go in, like you know what to expect. Otherwise, you go in with big hopes, you come out dejected, you come out feeling like the system is broken, which sometimes it is and it needs fixing, but then you get a very negative, how do you say, it's like a bitter aftertaste, you know, and then it stops young people from engaging in the process, which is the exact opposite of what we want. So I think that it's very important to have that clarity before you go in, rather than just thinking of something and then being very, very disappointed by the end of it.
I was talking with Navroz of CPR in an earlier, in fact, last year we did, during COP, we spoke with him for an interview. And I was asking him a question that I think is probably right again to ask. You know, I was asking him, how does he, you know, manage to not stay depressed? You know, the whole issue, you know, especially when you're tracking negotiations, when you're seeing it for like over, you know, 5 to 10 years, then, you know, the snail pace that things move, you know, compared to the urgency that we talk about, how do you manage to, you know, make sure that it doesn't get passed on? Like, you know, you were mentioning about the expectations that need to be set for the youth, that they're not going to necessarily in the first COP that they attend make the, you know, make a change, add the words that they want, add the word climate emergency in the negotiations. You know, it might happen, might not happen, right? So how do you do that, and how do you stay sane?
I think it's different each time. Like, honestly, I think for me, the biggest thing to stay sane at a COP is really to just think that, okay, you know, this is going to happen next year again. And that could also be really, really saddening at some point, because at some point you feel like, you know, you're meeting year after year, or, you know, every 6 months, and like you're making very, very small incremental progress. And sometimes you don't feel like that incremental progress is even happening. But I think what is really, really outside of the negotiation room sometimes, what is also inspiring is just the different, you know, people that you meet there. Because you get to see that people are doing so much. And from every single corner of the world, whether it's young people or not young people, and with young people, of course, also the more and more youth are getting involved at COPs, but also outside. Like, it's really, really inspiring to see that change is happening bottom up. But even outside, across age groups, intergenerationally, you can see, you know, there are so many people doing so many different things. Let it be innovation, or let it be policy advocacy, or let it be like grassroots change, or whatever that might be, or community engagement, or anywhere in between, you know. And I think that, to just see that the sheer volume and the mass of that, and like how many people are now involved in this, is also very, very inspiring at one point. To really just feel like, you know, we're actually pushing for change at different levels. And I think change at this point is inevitable, whether we like it or not. Decision makers, policy makers, and the companies in charge will have to change the way that they're working. So that is, I think, one of the biggest things. But the second is also, I think, especially in the focus of the COP, I think is also just trying to understand how it works, right? Like really understanding the process really well. And like speaking to other people who've been there for the past, I don't know how many years, like that really helps to me. Speaking with heads of delegations. I've actually asked the same question just 6 months ago at the intersessions to a bunch of heads of delegations. Because at the intersessions, there were, you might have heard as well, for the agenda, they took like 2 weeks. And on the final last day was when they finally adopted the agenda for the event. We should have been done on day one, 2 weeks ago. And that itself, I mean, by the end of it, I was like, you know, if we can't agree on a simple agenda, I don't know how we're actually even thinking of making progress 6 months later at COP. So I think just those conversations with different heads of delegations, or even just people there that were there, really, really helped me, because it brings in different perspectives. It helps me understand what it is for each country, especially for example, island states. How are they dealing with situations like this? If you're a head of delegation from a small country in the Pacific or in the Caribbean, each of these little things make a large amount of difference when you go back home. So I think just what really helps me is to try and understand different perspectives of it, different sides of like the negotiations, different sides of how it's working. What does it really mean? You know, when you're saying we're making progress, like, what does it mean in terms of like, from the outside, it might not seem like progress, but maybe you're actually changing things little by little because it is a technical process. So also like celebrating little wins really helps to like keep your spirits up during these times.
So do you train young people, I mean, like you said, about to understand negotiations, do you also train them about the kind of interventions that they need to make that are important for young people? Like, you know, if you're talking about, like you were talking about the island, people from the island states, do we also talk about, like, you train them also probably on the issues that they have and how they get their issues to come, bring into the negotiation table. Similarly, for young people also, do you do that? Like, do you train them on how you bring young people issues onto the table?
Yeah, so when I was global focal point for Yango, or basically what Yango does is trains young people on precisely this. So how do you engage, taking, you know, for example, consultations with young people from across the world. There's a conference of youth that has an outcome statement, which is a global youth statement, which also basically has a collated outcome of different youth conferences that happen in a few months in the lead up to that. So when I was global focal point for Yango, and when I was active in Yango, that's exactly what I did. Was to train from the youth agenda, what our demands are, trying to understand that, what do young people want, regardless of which part of the world we come from, regardless of different, you know, government situations and positions. But now, as part of the Youth Negotiators Academy, it is a very different role. So now we train young negotiators. So basically, we train country delegates. These people are all nominated by their country. So we sign agreements or MOUs with countries where they nominate young people. They agree that the youth will have a negotiating mandate. And then we basically give them, it's a technical training. It's not it's not a training on country positions, because ours is a more neutral, like understanding the UNFCCC thematic side of training. So that's what we do. So it's understanding the UN process, understanding the UN, like then we get into thematics of different negotiating tracks. Of course, what's at stake at each negotiation session. So of course, this one is focused a lot on the loss and damage. It's focused on the stock take. So it has a lot of, it's a lot more in depth, because the training goes over 6 months. So it's very technical. It's very thorough, because they need to be sitting on the tables making these decisions for their country. So they need to know all of this when they go in. So it's very different than what the Observer, what I used to do with Yango. I mean, it's similar, but it's a lot more in depth, sort of getting to the crux of things, because they need to be at those tables negotiating with seniors, you know, maybe double their age, or, you know, with a lot of experience. So they need to be able to sit there and make those same decisions.
Yeah, no, I completely understand the importance of it. In fact, I was tracking the Montreal Protocol negotiations. It's a smaller group, right? Smaller group with less number of people attending negotiations. I saw a lot of challenges there. In COP, at least, you know, you have a lot more people. There's a lot more delegations from countries. In Montreal Protocol, you know, people from African countries who are French speaking, they kind of, you know, they were not as trained as they should have. I'm glad you guys are doing this, because I feel, you know, that negotiators should know, you know, the whole process, what is required, what, you know, what their stance are, because they are representing their countries. And I think it's very interesting that you guys are doing this.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see. Even when in our training, we've had so many senior negotiators and even some heads of delegation say, you know, we wish that we had this training when we started. And that's, I mean, of course, they've learned it over the few years that they've been part of the process. And some of them have been here for a long time. But it's really interesting to see that so many national delegations really don't have the capacity building. People just thrown in the deep end and have to figure it out. And these are people who are making decisions for some of the most important issues that, you know, mankind has ever faced. So it is really, really, I mean, it is a challenge. And I think, like, trainings at all levels, we're focusing at young people, so between the ages of 18 to 35. But I think, like, we need training at all levels across stakeholders.
Yeah, so I was asking, I mean, I remember one of our conversations, Rakesh and I were talking about, very recently, I think day before yesterday only, said that our, you know, we see that mostly young people, their understanding is very black and white. Like, whoever is committing a mistake should pay for it, should be punished. And whoever, you know, is polluting should pay for that. It's very black and white, but negotiations don't work like that, right? So there is a lot of, you know, ifs and buts that are there, and something that might not look so fair. So what do you think about it? And even what are your views about it?
Well, I think from the principal point of view, the UNFCCC is also quiet. I mean, it works on the principle of CBDRRC, which is common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. So short acronym for a few words. But basically what it means is that we're there, we have common responsibilities, but each country has different capabilities where it comes from, which means that historically, it's a different responsibility if you've been a major polluter and have caused, you know, what we're facing the impacts today of, to develop, versus countries that are developing today. So a lot of Africa, a lot of Asia, especially India and China, who are now, you know, on the brink of moving from, you know, transition from developing countries to maybe developed in the next few years. So I think these are like big, I mean, at the essence of the UNFCCC, these are sort of embedded in it. But then again, this depends on, a lot of it depends on interpretation. And this is what happens in the negotiations. There's so much of it left to, you know, how do you interpret different wordings? What does it mean? How are even these principles interpreted in practice? Like, how did they really, the whole accountability mechanism, the whole idea of common but differentiated responsibilities, the whole idea of polluter pays, can also be twisted in different ways. So I think like this is the nuances where like the nuances are basically the most complicated bit of the UN, and which is I think also sometimes very frustrating, especially to young people, because you go in with a lot of different expectations. And then unfortunately you see it moving one way or another, or constantly moving up and down sometimes over 2 weeks. And it can be quite even emotionally draining to just be able to deal with all of that.
Yeah. Like Sneha was saying, you know, we were just talking how, you know, young people have like that clear, thinking ki, once you start following negotiations or once you go into the real world, in fact, what you start seeing is everything is gray. Okay, like no, like how do you bring everyone together if you don't agree or if you don't negotiate, right? That we thought, you know, that's why we thought, you know, maybe this year we should also try and talk with more young people and see, because that is a perspective that goes missing. That perspective of black and white is something that young people are more. They can hold people accountable to saying that, you know, one, of course, that we didn't pollute, and then that this is what is happening. This is what. So it's really something that we wanted to bring out in this series this year.
I'll just add one more thing to that, Rakesh. I remember this conversation, and I'm drawing from what, you know, we listen about the UN's role in different countries, right? So, you know, we see a lot of criticism coming to UN about how, you know, they respond to a lot of crises. So, I mean, in the similar context, I mean, I have heard myself in my conversation with a lot of my friends, when I talk to them about COP, what is going to happen, I'm reading about COP. You just say, nothing's going to happen. It happens every year, and, you know, people gather and just talk and just go away. So that is a very popular perception, especially among people who don't engage at first. So, I mean, from a distance, it looks, lot more complicated and also quite insignificant to a lot of people, which is not true. So, I mean, how do you think more and more people, I mean, I have, you have spoken about it, but what do you think about this perception in general?
I think, well, it depends, right? There is so much at stake at a COP. But I think the other thing to also remember is that the COP is like a ship, but it's only going to move as fast as we sort of, let's say, you know, like a, say, it's like a rowing boat. So it's only going to move as fast as we row. Because the UN here, especially in the UN climate change system, is sort of only the secretariat. It is the space that countries come together to. But at the end of the day, decision makers, it is, and which is why it's called an intergovernmental process, which means that the decision makers are the governments. So only as much as fast as we row is how the ship is going to move forward. So we need the ship, we need the UN, we need this happening year after year, because it brings in accountability. At least like people have to come and make, you know, in front of 197 countries, you have to make certain commitments. So it keeps that slight pressure alive. And now, of course, with the media, with young people, with so many different stakeholders and a lot of media attention, I think that pressure is mounting a little bit, or at least I hope it's mounting a little bit. But at the end of the day, it is not going to go anywhere if governments are not doing anything. So you can then complain and say, you know, it happens year after year, and, you know, this is actually doesn't change anything. Whereas the COP is actually just meant for people to come together and sort of make decisions. At the end of the day, you have to go back and implement those decisions, or at least make sure that you're making decisions that are at least ambitious enough to lead us in the right direction. So if you make the right decisions to start off with, and then step number two is to go back and like really work on implementing those decisions. I mean, you could make the best decisions and then not do anything, and that still doesn't work. We will have the best outcomes at COP, but like no change in real life. Or you could have okay decisions, but at least countries go back and like you do whatever that they're committing to. Or you could have a third where like, you know, nothing, sometimes just nothing works on either side of things. But yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember is that it is an intergovernmental process, and it is the role of the governments to make change. And we can sort of be those advocates as observers. We can push countries to do more. We can advocate, we can lobby, we can do a bunch of things to push them in the right direction. But they need to be making those decisions, and they need to be implementing them in their countries. So Yeah, it is going to remain, if as long as they don't do anything, it's going to be a year after year event. But it could also be a year after year event where, you know, we're making brilliant progress every year.
So what is your wish list from COP this year? Like, what do you hope happens, you know, in the COP this year?
Well, I think this year is a very, very special year. We've seen climate impacts in so many parts of the world. I think in every continent, we've seen impacts of climate change. And with the UAE just having floods a couple of days ago. So it has reached even the host country. You know, we're seeing impacts in every single part of the world. I don't think there's anywhere where we can deny or like sort of say that it's not happening quick enough or we have another, you know, X number of years to wait to make change. Like, I think that narrative is going to get redundant very, very soon. And I hope it happens already by this COP. And that we realize that climate change is here today. It's not something that we talk about in the next, you know, it's not a 2030 goal. It's not a 2050 goal anymore. So I think just the seriousness of that is the first thing. And then, of course, there are a couple of different things, right? This year is called as the year of the global stock take. So really taking stock of what countries have committed to over the past, you know, 5 years since the Paris Agreement was, you know, implemented, or at least since sort of, you know, to take stock of when we wanted to review and see what we're doing as per the Paris Agreement. So I think these are certain very important things to make sure, like, where are we really, like, are we really moving in the right direction? Are our commitments really taking us to where we want to be, where as of now all the reports are suggesting we're lagging behind? So I think these are a few things. And then, of course, loss and damage is a big discussion issue. COP27 was, you know, supposed to be historic because we had a fund that was agreed, but really operationalizing this fund, where is it going to sit? And I think like the meetings before COP have really sort of helped move them in certain direction. They haven't been the most hopeful. But I think really just seeing where can this go, what is this fund looking like, who's going to contribute to it, where is the fund sitting, how is the money going to be, you know, who's going to benefit from the fund, how quickly is that going to happen, what is the amount that is going in. So like the more technical aspects of, yes, we have a fund, like we've decided to have a fund and that's, let's celebrate, to like, okay, where do we go now that we've decided we're doing a fund? So yeah, a lot of like, I think this COP is a lot on like closing the loop at a few different levels. So I really hope we're able to get there and not leave open threads anymore. And especially given the current war situation in the Middle East, there are a lot of governments, and I have already heard of a few negotiators. We've had some of our young negotiators who are not going to be able to travel because their countries are not sending or are sending smaller delegations because of security issues. So it is going to impact delegation sizes, which means that it impacts how many people are in which room, what they're able to focus on, the topics that they're going to be able to focus on, how decisions are being made. So there is going to be a lot, other than climate change, there are a lot of other sort of factors that are going to play a very important role. And geopolitics is going to be center of this COP. So I think, this is one of the trickiest COPs that I have been to so far.
I also spoke to Aditya Mukherjee. Aditya started campaigning to stop the use of plastic straws in 2018. And at the age of 14, he went to different cafes and restaurants to persuade them to swap plastic straws for other eco-friendly options. He undertook an 18-month-long initiative to eliminate some 25 million plastic straws and other single-use plastic, which is why he was invited to be a part of the United Nations Youth Climate Action Summit in September 2019. I spoke to him to understand what pushed him to take this campaign up at such a young age and what response did he get as a kid. I asked him about his experience of being a part of big UN conferences on the environment.
I started out when I was 14 in 2018.
Okay, so you were 14 and this is a very tender age. I want to first of all ask you, when you started off, talking to people about it, being so young, what was the response?
It was a mixed response, actually. It started off by, like, people were not that aware of the issue or the fact that it was really a problem. So they were not really that open to having a discussion, especially with a 14-year-old kid, because they're like, what does a kid know about running a business or about life in general, or even about the problem? So,
all right. And I also wanted to understand, you know, because we are talking of climate negotiations, right? And how, I mean, this dialogue needs to have young people. So when did your journey start?
So for me, it started way back in 2018. I was just researching the internet, you know, as an inquisitive teenager, and I came across this video of two vets trying to extract a plastic straw out of a turtle's nose. And now the crying and the bleeding of the turtle really moved me as a 14-year-old and made me think about how selfish human beings are. Like, our single action, using a straw and throwing it away, has a great impact on other living beings who are unable to defend themselves or talk about their problems or even express it.
But I also wanted to understand from you, I mean, so as I said, that climate negotiations can get very complex, and a lot of times, you know, a lot of conversations just go haywire. We don't know what's going to happen, and it all ends up in taking up policies, taking up actions which are non-binding and really long-term, right? So, but I want to ask you, I mean, how youth voices are being heard? Are they being given some real attention other than just raising, you know, asking for accountability on that stage? But what kind of involvement does actually happens if someone, like a young person, wants to know how can they engage in that dialogue and what kind of response do they get on those forums? So I want to understand from you that.
In these platforms, it's to be these platforms are created so that youth voices can be heard. And it's not about just advocacy and holding accountable the government. Yes, that's one aspect of these conferences, but mostly it's to hear youth perspective on issues and what and the perspective, not just what problems the youth think are prevalent in climate change, but also what solutions and what are the pathways to these solutions being presented by the youth. So at the pre-COP event, I remember we drafted an entire document, the Youth for Climate document, which were in four different sections, and it highlighted various issues and what are the solutions and pathways to these issues. Now, you could say, was that thing implemented or not? That is it's an international contract. It may or may not be implemented to as good of a level, but what it brings about is the youth who have come there and the world leaders who had also pulled up to these events, they went back with a new idea, with new ways of tackling an issue.
Yeah, and also Aditya, because, you know, you were very young when you all started, you know, probably talking about it, maybe reading about it. And of course, a lot of times, this understanding in kids come much later in their lives, you know, not even in school, much later than that, probably in college or whenever they start working. So what do you want to tell other you know, kids who probably find a lot of times I've seen kids finding it boring, not really interesting to engage in conversation?
That's a very valid point. How do we convince youth who are afraid to talk? It's very simple. I tell them to start with friends and families. Every youth has their group of friends, they have their family. I said, start small, find an idea, find a solution, and first convince your friends and family, and then ask them to convince others. When I started out, I thought I will eliminate 50,000 plastic straws in 3 months. That will be my annual target. And within the first hotel I went to, removed 2.5 lakh straws per annum. So that beat my target by 5 times in the first go. And that really boosted my confidence to say, okay, I can do it. That's when I set a bigger target and a bigger target. I said, let's keep going. And that's what I would tell the youth, is to start small. There's no point of going out and saying, oh, I will change the world. That doesn't work. Go out and say, I will change those around me, and I will try and make an effort to help the planet. Because when it comes to climate action and saving the environment, no action is too small or too big. Every step counts. And that is what is important to remember.